Please be seated. All right, we have one case on our 10:30 docket, White versus Willenborg. The clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Hendricks.
May it please the court. Counsel, we're here involving a medical malpractice claim. Effectively what happened is my client was involved in a motor vehicle accident, actually two. The second motor vehicle accident required surgery on his ankle. He was not given antibiotics at the time. When he was given them, they didn't take, and a second surgery was required. So, in effect, we're dealing with a medical malpractice aggravation claim. As the justices are aware, Section 74.351B requires a doctor physician's report to be filed within 120 days of the suit. This suit was filed on December the 7th, 2009, and therefore under that statute, a report was required to be filed by April the 6th, 2010. That report was not filed. As the justices are also aware, under 74051D of the statute, each party is entitled to receive a complete and unaltered set of medical records within 45 days of requesting those. In this case in particular, the complete and unaltered set of the records was not received by the plaintiff. And as a result of that, the plaintiff was unable to get a physician to render a report and filed a motion to extend time with the trial court. The defendants filed a motion to dismiss under 74351, and the trial court granted that dismissal at the hearing. We have filed an appeal basically raising two issues. That is, did the failure of my client to receive the complete and unaltered set of his medical records give a reason for the court, allow the court to grant an extension? And if so, was that error by the court not granting the extension? And did the court err in granting the dismissal in this case because with the fact that my client had not yet received the medical records? And I'm fully aware that an issue like this has been decided by other courts of appeals other than this one. It seems to me, and what I'm asking this court of appeals to do, it seems to me that this case, that this situation and the way this statute has been interpreted makes it effectively impossible for a plaintiff without the defendant's assistance to prosecute a claim in this state. And effectively, no court has yet, as I see it, looked at the issue very in any great detail as to whether or not by the defendant's actions they can prevent a plaintiff from having his day in court simply by not providing the required records.
Wouldn't you have other remedies available to you? Couldn't you file a motion to compel their production with the trial court? And if you couldn't get an order, follow mandamus. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that that these two issues are tied together in the statute.
Well, they are insofar as the time it goes. And it, generally speaking, that would be correct. But there's not sufficient time in this instance. I mean, for example, once you get the records in, you send those records to some physicians for review, which you have to do immediately. You only have a short amount of time. And once you with the 120-day issue, if you don't get all the records, you truly don't have time to do that process.
But the 120-day time period is tied to the filing of the original petition. And the 45-day time period to provide the medical records is tied to the serving of the notice of claim, which do not have to, the notice of claim and the petition do not have to under the statute be filed at the same time. So you can file the notice of claim. You're required to wait 60 days. You should get your medical records within that 45 days if you have the authorization attached that's required by the statute. So I'm not seeing how they're tied. Help me see how they're tied together.
Well, they're only tied together as far as I see in that without tying them together, the ability to get the records, if they're not provided, is impossible under the time limit. I mean, under the best of both, unless you have your case in a can. I will agree that if you get hired 2 years before the statute of limitations runs and you have 2 years to get this ready, that is you would then be able to, in effect, follow what the statute, I think, has been interpreted to be. But if you're hired close to the statute of limitations time, you file it, effectively you have 135 days, and that is to recognize you don't have all the records and see if you have sufficient records to get a report. And then if within that point in time you can't get a continuance according to the defendants in this case of any kind, so if you file a mandamus, the 120 days runs and you're done. Even if, say, you file for it and the court says, okay, I deny that they give them to you, or even if they grant they give them to you, by the time you get them, the 120 days is done, unless it is tied together such that the failure to give the records somehow abates this 120-day period, it's practically and physically impossible to comply with that statute. Buying an extra 15 days is of no help whatsoever. And when the court, when you say I don't see that they're tied together, that is, I'm not trying to play hide the ball here. I think that's what the other courts have held. They're not tied together. I'm here asking you to hold that they are. And the reason I am is, from a practical standpoint, unless you have your case in a can, you do not have time to file a mandamus, to file these motions and get a hearing and do all the things that are required. As a practice, you can't get a hearing in any. I can't tell you can't get one in Texarkana, but there are very few counties in this state that you can get a hearing that would allow you time to do that. And filing a mandamus, as you know, under the statute, wouldn't toll anything. It doesn't do you any good.
Wouldn't you have to have your suit filed in order to file a motion to compel?
Of course. Of course. It really only buys you 15 days. I mean, it's a practical matter. And you would not only have to have your suit filed, but theoretically you would have to have them file an answer. But that's, you know, that there's a lot of timing issues in this, and that's the problem. And there's a lot of problems with this statute, period. I got to tell you, I'm not a fan of it, but nevertheless, it is what it is. I mean, but for example, one of the issues raised by Dr. Willenberg in his response is that we have waived this and effectively have not preserved this issue, because we didn't, at the trial court level, we didn't say that it was their fault that they did this. In other words, he's saying if it's required that we get the records from another third party, that they don't have anything to do with that, and therefore it hasn't been preserved for appeal. Well, the statute says specifically that we're entitled to a complete and unaltered copy of the records, and that all we have to do, all the plaintiff has to do, is file a request. Now, it's my position that puts a burden on the health care provider to provide a complete and unaltered copy.
I read Dr. Willenberg. on Burke's Creek to be more that there's not in the record exactly what records are missing or how they would have prevented the creation of an expert report.
That's his second point. And my response to that is that there's no authority anywhere that says, I mean, this is more on the lines of a motion for continuance. I think I could have gone to the hearing and done it orally and just said, I need an extension of time, Judge, because I don't have the records, and that the court, that's all that would have been required. There's nothing in the statute or nothing in any case that they've cited that says in this instance I have to file affidavits and I have to file the records that I've got. I have to file what would effectively be a doctor's report. I'm sorry. No, I filed it written.
Statement, but are there oral statements in the reporter's record of the hearing on your motion to extend the time to file an expert report? Are there statements in there as to which records are missing and why they are critical to you obtaining an expert report?
The record, as I recall it, specifically says that I was unable to get the records from any of the first treatments, which, when you're dealing with an aggravation case, is, according to the doctors I've talked to, is very important. And that is in the record, yes. In fact, I think it is even quoted in Dr. Willenberg's brief that those statements were made. But I don't think it even has to go that far. I mean, I think from what I see, I mean, I've done this a long time. I've made dozens and dozens of oral motions for continuance and extension of time in trial courts and had them granted and denied either way, but it certainly was not a situation in which I had to have a record of all the specificity. I think what the requirement is that it show that the court made an informed decision, in effect, that the court was aware of the issue and that the court made an informed decision and ruled on it either explicitly or implicitly. That's another one of the defendant's arguments is, well, the court, there's no ruling. Well, clearly when the court that day granted a motion to dismiss, that's an implicit ruling on my request for extension of time.
I agree with you. I don't think you are required to have anything in writing to, or have evidentiary issues in writing to preserve error. But would you agree that the standard of review, that we review the trial court's denial of your motion for extension of time to file an expert report, would be an abuse of discretion? And so having facts in the record showing why you need the extension of time and which records you don't have would be helpful to an abuse of discretion analysis.
Well, yes, I do, Your Honor. And the answer to that is yes, and the record is certainly clear enough in that regard in that I told him specifically, I didn't say I don't have Dr. So-and-so's records from this date, but I said I don't have the records from the first treatment. If I think the court's ruling, which is in the record, makes it clear that he understood the issue and that his ruling was based upon what he understood to be the current status of the law. That is, he had no discretion. And so, in effect, in this case, in particular, I think that the true issue is, does he have discretion that he could have abused, I guess. And so, and then that's their final argument is, well, obviously he didn't abuse his discretion because the law is that the two are not tied together, and therefore he has no discretion. And my stance as it relates to that is as simple as it can be. That is, if you look at any statutory construction in the world, it says you construe the whole statute. If you don't have sufficient time, or if one party does not comply with their requirements under the statute, then allowing them to walk away from that requirement by simply saying, well, there's just nothing we can do, is an improper, inequitable, and completely unjust ruling. And I think it's not a correct construction of a statute. When you have each party with a burden, one party does not comply with that burden, and then the second party, to have the courts to tell the second party, well, that's tough, you have the most draconian remedy of all, you lose your lawsuit, seems to me to be a glitch in this statute that everybody has just sort of, all the courts have just, that have looked at it, just sort of said, well, That's just the way it is. Well, I don't think that's the way it is, and I don't think that's what should be intended, and I don't think that is a just result. So that's why I'm here. And, I mean, I know I'm swimming upstream, and I understand that I'm not trying to play hide the ball from you, but this is – it's not right. And holding them to be independent duties with no, absolutely zero consequences for not following and completing that duty, and then having a draconian result of dismissal for the other person not following that duty, cannot be proper construction of what the law should be in this state.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Mr. Thornton.
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, as you pointed out, the standard before us today is an abuse of discretion standard. In order for this court to find that there was error in the trial court below and to reverse the trial court's decision, this court is going to have to ignore well-established authority and the statute itself. And this court is going to have to do in an abuse of discretion with that which it should not do. Number one being that it should ignore the guiding rules and principles applicable to this circumstance, and two, that it should graft onto an unambiguous and clear statute. The position advocated by the appellant in this matter has no support in law or in the record. Today, what we're hearing essentially is an argument that the statute is unconstitutional, and a claim that because based on the facts in this case, this claimant doesn't get his day in court. That was the tenor of the argument. That wasn't raised below, and that's not an issue raised before this court. The issue before this court is whether or not the trial court had any discretion when faced with a fact that is beyond dispute and is undisputed. That is, within 120 days of filing suit, the appellant, one, did not file any expert report. Two, within that 120-day deadline, the appellant did not file any motion to extend. Under those circumstances, the trial court had no discretion other than to, one, grant the motion to dismiss, and two, deny the motion to extend. And there's three on-point cases that deal with almost the exact same circumstances. And they're cited in our in Dr. Willenborg's brief. They're the Brockstermann case out of Dallas. There's the Garza case out of the Edinburgh Corpus Christi Court. And then there's the Regis case out of the Houston Court of Appeals. In each one of those cases, the argument was raised that because the claimant did not get medical records or materials from one of the defendants, that claimant was entitled to an extension under circumstances in which that extension was filed either the day the expert report was due or the day after the expert report was due, or sometime after, not necessarily the day after. So the easy shortcut to this case is that there is no abuse of discretion by Judge Collier in this case because he had no discretion. The statute in the case law required dismissal and required that the motion to extend is denied. Now, even if you want to say, for the sake of argument, let's address the merits of the extension sought, the request that the appellant has before you today has no merit in the law or the facts. In the Lone Star HMA case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, there was a request not on this specific issue, but that for the same reasons, because of justice and because it would work better, there should be an alteration to Chapter 74. And the Dallas Court of Appeals on that said, we cannot legislate. We cannot graft onto an unambiguous statute. And this statute is unambiguous. And the key is that Article 4590I allowed good faith extensions under certain circumstances. When Chapter 74 was passed, the legislature specifically removed the ability to get any extension unless two things occurred. One, the parties agreed to the extension. We don't have that here. And two, an expert report was filed in a timely manner. We don't have that here. So based on the plain language of the statute and very basic law separating the judiciary from the legislature, there's no legal basis on which this court can grant the relief that the appellant requests. Second, and Justice Walker, as you pointed out, there is no support in the record for the claim that is being asserted. And the thing that we're dancing around with here, and the appellant won't come out and say it, but the issue is not that either Dr. Willenborg or Louisville Hospital did not give the appellant all of his records. In fact, that was specifically raised by me in front of the trial judge, because the only thing that was said to the trial judge were vague, I don't have all of my client's records, I had to go get the records, I have the records now, but I don't have a report. Now, the statute does not require defendants to go gather the claimant's medical records from other sources. And there's nothing in the record that there's one, there's no law that says we have to do that. Two, as you aptly pointed out, there is nothing in the record that says what's missing. And if you read pages 4 through 7 of the record, and actually on page 7 of the record shortly before I spoke, appellant's counsel said that he actually had these missing records before the hearing and hoped to have a report, but didn't. And so we have no idea, this court has no idea, what records were missing, who they came from, why they weren't obtained earlier, and, as you pointed out, why it was that a report couldn't be obtained earlier. Because we know plenty of times claimants get reports, the trial court reviews the merits of those reports, and even if the report is lacking, the appellant has the ability or the claimant has the ability to get an extension. Even in situations where it's missing, this court heard the Santillan case a while ago, and the issue there was that, well, this report didn't have certain things in it, and so it was no report. And this court said, no, you're entitled to an extension. We didn't have anything here of that nature. So under the circumstances, actually, and I cited the Lynn case in my brief, where we have no record on exactly what records we're talking about and why they're important, the trial court is presumed to have found the facts necessary to support its judgment. And the judgment that the trial court exercised in this matter was denial of the appellant's motion for extension of time. The last point quickly that I would like to make is the issue about preserving the complaint on appeal, and this is a perfect example. You know, the appellate rules require that to preserve a complaint on appeal, it has to be brought to the trial court's attention with sufficient specificity so it knows the issue. And as you pointed out, it's clear from reviewing the record, the trial court wasn't really sure what was going on, and there was no evidence of what was going on, so it denied the motion to extend. And again, we don't have, in fact, even today, the appellant's counsel did not stand up before you and say, we are missing Dr. Willenborg's records from these dates, and here's the evidence in the record. Or we are missing the Louisville Hospital records from these dates, and here is the evidence in the record. We are continually given this vague reference to some records, which he had before the hearing, but has never produced or given anybody or identified to this day. So, justices, based on those reasons, as well as the arguments set forth in more detail in Dr. Willenborg's brief, Dr. Willenborg would request that you affirm the trial court's judgment in this matter.
Let me clarify one thing you said.
Yes, ma'am.
You said there's no indication as to which records are missing. When you say which ones, do you mean Dr. Willenborg's records or versus Louisville's records, or are we talking about some other doctor's records, or do we not, we don't know any of the above?
We don't know, and I can give you quotes from, and I'm reading from page 4 of the records.
Okay.
He had care before and after this lawsuit. He, being the expert, said, I can't give you a report without the other records. Later on, appellant's counsel on the record, page 5, says, I had to go get initial medical records, and I still don't have a report. And then I went back and specifically said, Judge, I think we're talking about other records, and that was left. So
I mean, like there could be some radiology report that's missing that we don't know.
There could be records from completely other physicians, other hospitals. He talks about that this guy, a gentleman, had two car wrecks.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Laws.
May it please the court. My name is Catherine Laws. I represent Columbia Medical Center of Louisville, counsel. As co-counsel indicated, this is a matter that is reviewed applying an abuse of discretion standard. When we look at the actions of the trial judge, we can see that he was clearly required to follow and did follow the mandates of Chapter 74. In particular, the statute states that the trial court shall dismiss a case if the report is not filed within 120 days. An issue has been raised in this court regarding some sort of marrying of the notice requirement found in 74.051 together with the expert report in requirement of 74.351. I think it's extremely important in this case to note that there is no evidence in the record below of a notice of intent to file lawsuit claim letter under 74.051. Even if the court were inclined to look at some sort of link between the two, there's no evidence that that would be applicable in this case. The exact circumstances that we're dealing with in this case have been addressed previously by the Houston 14th District Court of Appeals in Regis versus Harris County Hospital District. In that case, like this one, the plaintiff alleged that she was not able to get her medical records from the defendant hospital, and that was the reason that she failed to meet the 120-day expert report requirement. Of note, the court stated in that case that the statute did not contain a grace period and that they had no discretion but to dismiss the claim. In a footnote in that case, we find that the plaintiff provided evidence of letters showing her efforts to obtain her records and presumably attempting to show her due diligence in obtaining the information she needed. The court noted that the evidence was not properly before them, but even if it were, it did not compel a different result, that the dismissal was still appropriate. And that is in footnote 3 of the Regis case. There have been similar situations where a plaintiff has been unable to effectuate the requirement of the 120-day expert report. One of those is the PM Management Windcrest versus Sanchez case from San Antonio. In that case, the plaintiff was unable to meet the 120-day requirement because she could not locate the defendant to serve the report. The court in that case, again addressing similar equity-type issues, held that dismissal by the trial court was appropriate and was not an abuse of discretion. The appellant in this case cites the Gutierrez case for the proposition that we need to interpret the statute as a whole and that not requiring a penalty on the one hand while requiring it as to the 120-day expert report is improper. What Gutierrez actually states is that we need to look at the language of the statute and the plain language. There it's talking about the service requirement, but it certainly doesn't stand for the proposition that we can manufacture a marriage of the notice requirement and the expert report requirement. Be happy to answer any question the justices may have.
All right, thank you, Ms. Laws. Mr. Hendricks.
May it please the court, very briefly. Just to address the points that were raised by counsel, there is no requirement of which I'm aware that a motion to extend time be filed within a 120-day time period. I don't know that there's even a vehicle for it. It was, the motion was filed before the dismissal hearing and in time to have it heard and was heard by the court. The argument that I'm asking this court to legislate is incorrect. I'm asking this court to interpret a statute. It has been called unambiguous by counsel, and yet he makes a statement which says we have no requirement to provide other relevant medical records other than our own to the claimant. Well, that's the statute says. It doesn't say in your possession. It doesn't say that of your records. It says that the plaintiff, the claimant, is entitled to a complete and unaltered copy of his medical records or her medical records, and that all they have to do is file a request. To allow a defendant to do something such as to segregate records. Well, I've reviewed these records, but I'm not going to provide them because these are my records. That's not allowed under the statute, I don't think. It's because it says complete and unaltered copies. So to argue this, to say I don't have that obligation when the statute gives you that obligation shows to me that the statute is at least ambiguous and it relates to what records have to be provided, because it doesn't distinguish between provider and it doesn't distinguish between possession. It just says complete and unaltered, and those were not provided. The question of that, and this is the box that I'm that I guess the statute puts me in. I mean, I'm certainly not arguing that these lawyers are taking their position, and they're doing exactly what I would do if I was on their side and I had the statute. But the box that it puts a claimant in, that is, they're saying under one hand, well, wait a minute, you didn't have a report at the hearing for dismissal, which was 150 days after. But it doesn't matter because after 120 days, you're dead. They're saying you didn't have evidence of what records were missing, which is that's an incredible argument to me, in that I did not offer evidence to prove something I don't have. I don't know if I have all the records today. I don't know that's the case, and I don't know how I would know that, because I don't think that's my obligation. And I don't think, not only do I not have to offer evidence of it, I don't think it's my obligation. I think the statute says all I have to do is file a request and that they have to provide those to me. And on the no notice of filing the claim, which I guess they're arguing some kind of a waiver, as you know, that is a jurisdictional issue, there's evidence that was filed by, there's no pleading in this court which says that there was no notice of claim filed. Which would be a jurisdictional issue for the court, and clearly by them not raising that in their pleadings, there's some evidence, at least inferred, that from which the court can infer that was filed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Mr. Thornton, Ms. Laws, we appreciate your arguments, your submission today, and your briefing on this case. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We